This chapter describes how the Lord appeared before the demigods when they offered him their prayers. Following the advice of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the demigods executed a truce with the demons for the purpose of churning nectar from the ocean, from the sea. Because of the prayers offered by the demigods in the previous chapter, Lord Shiradakshayi Vishnu was pleased with the demigods, and thus he appeared before them. The demigods were almost blinded by his transcendental bodily effulgence. At first, therefore, they could not even see any part of his body. After some time, however, when Brahma could see the Lord, he, along with Lord Shiva, began to offer the Lord prayers. Lord Brahma said, "The Supreme Personality of Godhead, being beyond birth and death, is eternal. He has no material qualities, yet he is the ocean of unlimited auspicious qualities. He is subtler than the most subtle. He is invisible, and his form is inconceivable. He is worshipable for all the demigods. Innumerable universes exist within his form, and therefore he is never separated from these universes by time, space, or circumstances. He is the chief and the pradhan. Although he is the beginning, the middle, and the end of the material creation, the idea of pantheism conceived by Mayavadi philosophers has no validity. The Supreme Personality of Godhead controls the entire material manifestation through his subordinate agent, the external energy. Because of his inconceivable transcendental position, he is always the master of the material energy. The Supreme Personality of Godhead in his various forms is always present even within this material world. But the material qualities cannot touch him. One can understand his position only by his instructions as given in the Bhagavad Gita. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita 10.10, Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam. Buddhi Yoga means Bhakti Yoga. Only through the process of Bhakti Yoga can one understand the Supreme Lord. When offered prayers by Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead was pleased. Thus he gave appropriate instructions to all the demigods. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is known as Ajita, unconquerable, advised the demigods to make a peace proposal to the demons so that after formulating a truce, the demigods and demons can churn the ocean of milk. The rope would be the biggest serpent known as Vasuki, and the churning rod would be Mandara Mountain. Poison would also be produced from the churning, but it would be taken by Lord Shiva, and so there would be no need to fear it. Many other attractive things would be generated by the churning, for the Lord warned the demigods not to be captivated by such things. Nor should the demigods be angry if there were some disturbances. After advising the demigods in this way, the Lord disappeared from the scene. Following the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the demigods established a peace with Maharaj Bali, the king of the demons. Then both the demons and the demigods started for the ocean, taking Mandara Mountain with them. Because of the great heaviness of the mountain, the demigods and demons became fatigued, and some of them actually died. Then the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, appeared there on the back of his chariot, Garuda, and by his mercy he brought these demigods and demons back to life. The Lord then lifted the mountain with one of his hands and placed it on the back of Garuda. The Lord sat on the mountain and was carried to the spot of the churning by Garuda, who placed the mountain in the middle of the sea. Then the Lord asked Garuda to leave that place because as long as Garuda was present, Vasuki could not come there. So text 1. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, "O King Parikshit, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Hari, being thus worshipped with prayers by the demigods and Lord Brahma, appeared before them. His bodily effulgence resembled the simultaneous rising of thousands of suns. The vision of all the demigods is blocked by the Lord's effulgence, thus they could see neither the sky, the directions, the land, nor even themselves, what to speak of seeing the Lord who was present before them. Lord Brahma, along with Lord Shiva, saw the crystal clear personal beauty of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose blackish body resembled a marakata of gem, whose eyes are reddish like the depths of a lotus, who is dressed with garments that are yellow like molten gold, and whose entire body is attractively decorated. They saw his beautiful, smiling, lotus-like face, crowned by a helmet, bedecked with valuable jewels. The Lord has attractive eyebrows, and his cheeks are adorned with earrings. Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva saw the belt on the Lord's waist, the bangles on his arms, the necklace on his chest, and the ankle bells on his legs. The Lord is bedecked with flower garlands, his neck is decorated with a kastuba gem, and he carries with him the goddess of fortune and his personal weapons, like the disc and club. When Lord Brahma, along with Lord Shiva and the other demigods, saw the form of the Lord, they all immediately fell to the ground, offering their obeisances. Oh, you put on text 3. Okay, we'll just read text 8. Lord Brahma said, although you are never born, your appearance and disappearance as an incarnation never cease. They are always free from the material qualities. You are the shelter of the transcendental bliss, resembling an ocean. Eternally existing in your transcendental form, you are the supreme subtle of the most extremely subtle. We therefore offer respectful obeisances unto you, the Supreme, whose existence is inconceivable. Purport. The Lord says in the Bhagavad Gita 4:6, Ajopi san navayatma, bhutanam ishvaropi san, prakritim swam adishtaya, sambhavam yatma maya. Although I am unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all sentient beings, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. The following verse in Bhagavad Gita 4:7, the Lord says, Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati varata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham. Whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice of descendant of Bharat and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. Thus, although the Supreme Lord is unborn, there is no cessation to his appearance in different forms as incarnations like Lord Krishna and Lord Rama. Since his incarnations are eternal, the various activities performed by these incarnations are also eternal. The Supreme Personality of Godhead does not appear because he is forced to do so by karma, like ordinary living entities who are forced to accept a certain type of body. It is to be understood that the Lord's body and activities are all transcendental. Being free from the contamination of the material modes of nature, these pastimes are transcendental bliss to the Lord. The word apariganya damne is very significant. There is no limit to the Lord's appearance in different incarnations. All these incarnations are eternal, blissful, and full of knowledge. Lord Brahma said, although you were never born, your appearance and disappearance as an incarnation never cease. You are always free from the material qualities, and you are the shelter of transcendental bliss resembling an ocean. Eternally existing in your transcendental form, you are the supreme subtle of the most extremely subtle. We therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto you, the Supreme, whose existence is inconceivable. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Buddhaya Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Saraswatam Deve Gauravani Vicharane Nirvishesha Srinivadi Paskatya De Siddharna. Here the demigods are on the shore of the ocean of milk offering prayers, and finally Krishna appears. So this is nice. Question is, what does this have to do with us? First of all, most of us can't go to the shore of the ocean of milk. And even if we got there, we wouldn't know what to do anyhow. Scoop up a few gallons of milk and make curd or something. But even we offered prayers, it's unlikely Sri Radhakrishna Vishnu is going to come before us. Of course, if we could go to the ocean milk, I'm sure our faith in some of the Bhagavatam stories would greatly increase. But for us, it's more or less almost like fiction to hear about these stories. And here, Brahma with four heads, and Lord Shiva with the Ganges on his head, and snakes around his neck, and skulls, garland with skulls around his neck, is offering prayers, along with Indra with unlimited eyes all over his body. So these things are not within our experience. So the question is, what relevance does it have for us? First of all, as official members of the Hare Krishna movement, we have to believe in this. We're supposed to believe in it, at least, officially at least. And we're actually supposed to say it's real. There are actually people with four heads and with Ganges sprouting from their hair and garlands of skulls and snakes, and there are actually oceans of milk and salt water and sugar cane juice and curd and liquor. There are actually oceans millions of times bigger than the salt ocean. And there is God, who has four arms, and he lies down in the ocean of milk in his own planet. So we're supposed to officially believe this, but we have no experience. How much do we really believe in it? So what's the connection between reading the eighth canto, hearing about this, and reality? Because all this keeps on saying is that Krishna is God. It's real. It's real. Believe it. Thanks. I believe. I've accepted Shiradakshaya Vishnu in my heart, and now I have peace of mind, along with Brahma and Shiva and all the demigods. So what is the point? The point is that actually our real faith has to come back to what we've actually experiencing. And that may be to different degrees. Krishna begins the ninth chapter, the most important chapter in the Bhagavad Gita. The essence of all the Vedic literature, all 100 billion verses in the Vedic literature are all found within the Bhagavad Gita, summarized in the Bhagavad Gita, and Bhagavad Gita has 18 chapters, of which the middle six are the most important, and out of those, the ninth chapter is most important. Therefore, all the Vedic knowledge is summarized in the ninth chapter. And there, Krishna begins by saying, because you're not envious of me, therefore I'll explain to you this most confidential knowledge and realization. And then he says, this is the king of knowledge, the most secret of all secrets, the purest knowledge. And it's because it gives one direct perception of the self by realization. It's the perfection of religion, and is everlasting, joyfully performed. And then he says, those who are not faithful on this path cannot achieve me. Therefore, they come back to repeated birth and death in this world. So it's not that everyone, although we're here up to the eighth canto, it's not that we have any more realization of what's going on here than when we were on the first canto. We may not necessarily. Of course, we're supposed to, by assimilating this knowledge, by the time we get up to the eighth canto, be able to experience the demigods and the ocean milk, speaking to Shiradakshaya Vishnu, be able to visualize it and practically experience it and understand it, assimilate it. But we may not do that. Therefore, we may be in the category of Ashvadadana. We may not have much faith in what's going on here, and we may not have much realization. Of course, realization and faith are about the same thing. Therefore, the result is that one comes back to try again in the material world to develop that same faith and realization. So what is that faith and realization? How does it come about? The same thing is explained. Whether Brahma is speaking with Lord Shiva to Shiradakshaya Vishnu, or Narada Muni is sitting there as a young boy in the assembly of the sages, hearing about the glories of Krishna, and then going out into the forest, the same thing is there. One has to perform service to Krishna. Whether one is a demigod, or whether one is a great devotee, or whether one is a neophyte trying to practice devotional service, the same thing is there. Try to perform some activities for the pleasure of Krishna. And then, by such activities, if Krishna reveals himself, then our actual understanding of faith will develop. Otherwise, these things simply remain stories. what to speak of when we get up to the 10th canto. And there, a little boy, 5 years old, or 8 years old, actually, 8 years old. No, he's only 7 years old. 7 years old, lifts up Govardhan Hill with his left pinky and holds it there for 7 days. Sure, right. Then you go to India and you see Govardhan Hill, and in the Bhagavatam it's explained that Govardhan Hill was so tall at that time that when the sun god used to pass with his chariot, the horses on his chariot used to eat the grass on top of Govardhan Hill. In other words, it's quite a bit bigger than it is now. And this little boy, 8 years old, holds it up for 7 days in his left pinky. And at the same time, he twirls a lotus flower just to keep himself busy in the same hand. So how can we believe that? Actually, we don't believe it. We really get down to it. Because we have no experience of it. We only really believe things and have faith in things we experience. But the whole idea is the Bhagavatam, that's why it's advised that we start at the beginning. Although when they read it in a sequential manner, going from the first verse all the way up to the end, but we shouldn't think just because I've gone through it, now I've understood everything. What's the next book? Actually, the Bhagavatam is meant for actually realization. It's supposed to be after we assimilate the knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita, the knowledge about the difference between matter and spirit, develop faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, understood how the three modes of material nature have worked, come to the conclusion that we have to surrender to Krishna and engage fully in his service, then the Bhagavatam begins from that point. But if we haven't understood Bhagavad Gita, then how can we understand fully or completely or adequately Srimad Bhagavatam enough? When we get up to the eighth canto, we just don't try and keep it out of our minds or something, or wonder what's really going on. Because when Prabhupada came out with the fifth canto, translated it, many devotees left. They said, this is ridiculous. They had faith that the scientists had gone up into space, gone to the moon or whatever, but when they hear about that there are trees 100,000 miles, which is probably, 150,000 kilometers tall, because if you go around the Earth planet, it's around, 32,000 miles around. So that's five times around the Earth planet. That's how big the trees are. One tree, at least. There are many trees. And they have fruits the size of elephants. Must be a very small fruit. Just little tiny fruits. And they drop from the tree, and they form oceans of sugar cane, rivers of mango juice and jackfruit juice and all kinds of jackberry juice, and different types of juices. So you look up in the sky, where is the juice? I mean, if one drop of that juice fell in here, maybe, wow. But it doesn't seem like there's anything to corroborate this within our experience. All we have is some book, some explanation of some, fifth canto, which seems quite incredible, that there are demigoddess and demigods and people floating around with apsaras and kanaras and chunaras and gandharvas. But we have no experience of these things. Because Sariputta was very much interested in the UFOs. He wrote a book about that. Probably the devotees thought, wow, this is really nice. Something interesting to read. All the experiences of the other aliens that we haven't seen, and maybe that develops a little bit more faith that there's something beyond what I've seen, but I haven't even seen an alien. I mean, how many people have here seen anyone here has ever seen an alien? Have you? Because when I was in Rotterdam, in Belgium, one day the devotees came in and they said, there was the spaceship just hovering around. They were all looking at it through a telescope with all the windows and everything, and then it disappeared. But I didn't see it. But, in other words, generally we really have faith in what we experience. Therefore, what is the point of all this sophisticated demigods, Brahma, Shiva, oceans of milk, oceans of sugarcane juice, etc.? Well, the point is that actually we shouldn't blindly accept it, because we can't blindly accept anything anyhow, nor should we blindly reject it. But we should try to get the essence of the whole, what's being explained here. The whole essence is to perform some service. Generally, the devotees have to take shelter of the first, of the beginning instructions of Bhagavad Gita, that we're not this body. That if we understand that we're not this body, that we're actually spiritual souls, then we can see how much illusion we're in. That should be our main meditation, is to see how my body's always changing, I'm always having a different state of consciousness, different types of awareness, conceptions of life, but I, the person within the body, are always the same. Therefore, I'm completely bewildered by material existence, so how much do I really know about what's going on here? Actually, I don't know very much. But the real problem is I think I know very much. Therefore, whenever things are explained to me from the Bhagavatam, immediately either I just think, oh, yeah, sure, right. I don't even question it, because I figure there's no point. If I question it, then everyone will say, what's wrong with you? How many regular principles have you been following lately? You don't believe, huh? And if I try to understand it, I have no means to understand it. There's no spaceship to take off and, you know, go to the ocean milk and cry out for pure Dr. Shai Vishnu for him to appear. So I have no means to realize it, and I have no means to reject it either. Therefore, it's not actually so important. What is important is that there's a process that's being explained within it. And if we follow that process, then gradually we'll begin to understand things and experience them. Namely, the first thing we have to understand is that there is a God, that there is someone controlling the universe, and it's not us. That there is a person who's actually can give me remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness, and it's explained here that he does so in proportion to our surrender. In other words, the more we engage in devotional service, the more we do it enthusiastically, then the more Krishna gives us intelligence to understand things properly. And if I'm anxiety how the universe is running, or whether there are demigods, or that will all become very simple and clear as we perform devotional service. If we can't believe that there are demigods controlling the universe, how are we going to believe that there's a God who's controlling the universe? If we think we're the actual standard of the whole universe, everything has to be measured according to our perceptions and conceptions of things, then how will we be able to understand how they're actually persons superior to us? And if we can't accept some demigod as superior to us, how can we accept that there is a real God? Therefore, most people's conception of God is that if God can do something for us, he's God. If he's not, he might as well just cease to exist and go away. Therefore, they go to church, they pray, my dear God, please give me a new color TV. My picture tube is not working. But if they can get the same color TV without going to church, and they think, what's the difference? You know, might as well work the extra hour and get the TV myself. Therefore, they're not generally interested. They think, oh, these stories are just fairy tales. Or if there is a God, his only real position is, you know, just to stay in the background and kind of like supply what I need. But then we find out here that God's actually a person, and it's not so easy to contact him. One actually has to become a little sincere. One has to go through some austerity. It's not that Brahma has his telephone, you know, special telephone line to share with Dr. Shai Vishnu. There's some trouble going on. He just calls him up on the telephone and says, hey, Vishnu, there's some problem. Can you solve it? You know, send out some of the Vishnu duties and fix it, you know. No, he personally has to go to the ocean of milk along with Lord Shiva, such powerful demigods, and they have to go through the same process we'd have to go through, namely to offer prayers to them and ask for some kind of benediction in that way. So similarly, if we want to understand Vishnu, Krishna, if we want to do something meaningful for him and for ourselves, then we also have to go through some kind of tapasya, some kind of austerity. It's not that we just, you know, call up Vishnu on the internet, you know, find out what his internet address is, contact him and tell him what we need, or, you know, send it by, you know, parcel post, express, whatever it is. No, we also have to find, we have to do the same thing, and the only thing that's required is a little faith. So if reading this eighth canto doesn't increase our faith, doesn't maybe perhaps decrease it, shouldn't decrease it, but we shouldn't take it so lightly that these are just some interesting stories that we're reading. You know, some kind of, you know, let's see what other amazing things goes on, you know. But not to take it very seriously, this is just some stories. But we should understand that this is beyond our conception, perception, realization, and just try to take the essence that everyone in the universe is a servant, no matter what position we have, and that if we serve Krishna, then gradually that Krishna will give us the intelligence by his mercy, so we'll be able to understand who we are and what's actually going on here in this universe. And that one has to be patient, and at the same time, one has to develop confidence. It's not that I'm going to be so patient that I'm just going to hear these stories the rest of my life and not believe this. No. We have to be patient, patiently hear, but with the idea of actually trying to do something to get some realization. So our actual faith and confidence increases, and that's the only way of maintaining our enthusiasm in devotional service. Otherwise, devotional service will just be some theoretical thing we do for a few years, you know, store up our pious credits. So worst comes to worst, I'll go to the heavenly planets. And if it doesn't work, then nothing works anyhow, so I didn't lose very much, just a few years. No, we should understand that one has to take it seriously enough that it actually has some meaning in one's life, that devotional service has to be cultivated so that our enthusiasm for making further progress in devotional service, so one day actually realizing Krishna is there. The whole science is delineated from Shuddha all the way up to Prema. It is not like an easy 1 minute, one recipe fits everyone. I don't have to go through any austerity. I just have to believe and everything will be all right. So this is the Christian philosophy we've been brought up with, or the modern religious philosophy. Just accept something superficially and everything will be all right. And as soon as we're challenged, just like we meet so many Christians all the time, and as soon as you challenge them a little bit, they get very disturbed. How dare you challenge me? You know, I'm a blind follower and you're trying to, you know, disturb my blind following. Don't you have any respect, you know? Don't you have any decency when you're dealing with people? You're trying to disturb me? Logic and arguments are just signs that you're controlled by the devil, because only the devil would come up with such logical arguments and reasoning to defeat my philosophy. So when you bring your logical arguments and reasoning, it's just proof that you're actually of the devil. So such persons, it's very hard to convince them logically and reasonably that what we're talking about is true. Similarly, we shouldn't be in the same mentality that I have my way of doing things, I have my mentality, I have my goal in life, I have my position, I have it all figured out. And, you know, if you're trying to convince me otherwise by your preaching, it's only because you're trying to take advantage and lording over me, which is contradictory to your philosophy, so you're just full of contradictions. You're trying to force me to do something I don't want to do, and therefore I have a good reason to reject you. I won't reject you outright, because I'll embarrass myself and embarrass you. I just won't listen to anything you said or take it seriously. That way I'll spite you, I'll cut my nose off, and you'll get hurt. Teacher, right. Therefore, the conclusion is that whatever we're hearing about, the essence is up to us to try to understand things more clearly. It's up to us to try and get a little bit more determined to execute some kind of service to Krishna in a way that actually fixes my mind upon Krishna. And by fixing my mind upon Krishna in the mood of devotion, if Krishna is pleased with my service and my devotion, then gradually, as he gives me experience of the happiness, the bliss that comes from him, the Ladini Shakti, then as my ignorance gets melted or burnt away, then these things become clear and simple. It's not that necessarily we'll see the demigods, but we'll see how Krishna is controlling everything in the universe within our present vision. Everything is, Krishna is in everyone's heart. Everyone is being directed by him. Therefore, if he's controlling everything here, why not throughout the whole universe? Stop there. Any questions? Yes.
In Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada defined faith as being unflinching trust in something sublime. Right? The Christians, and they see their teachings and Jesus Christ as being sublime. And we have the stories in the Bhagavatam which we perceive as being sublime, but we don't have so much any ability to perceive it directly with our senses. And
what makes you think we have faith? We only have some faith.
I don't know. But the question I'm asking is, if you know, pradaksha or our ability to, you know, reason is inferior to,
yeah, of course it is,
then what's the difference between that and blind faith?
Well, because if we hear it, then it's not blind anymore. We actually hear the message of the Bhagavatam, of Bhagavad Gita, then we'll be able to see it, experience it. There's no, we say that there's no difference between Krishna and his name. So if we actually hear the name as it actually is, not as we think it should be, then we actually experience Krishna fully just by chanting his name with full devotion. Then we'll actually experience it. Therefore, there won't be any difference between our experience and what's being explained. But it's proportionally to our development of faith. But now we're covered by the three modes of material nature, and not necessarily just by goodness. Therefore, we have so many doubts, because we can't experience purely or completely. The process is, by hearing though, in the right attitude, and therefore a lot of what we're hearing about is how to develop the proper attitude. So if we accept something along the line of what's being said and then practice that, then that will increase our ability to hear, and as our ability to hear increases, then our experience will increase. And as our experience increases, if we get a higher taste, then the result is we'll become more enthusiastic to hear more, to follow the process better, so we can actually increase our hearing. So there should be a progression between having some preliminary faith or a superior experience to being anxious to hear so we can understand something clear enough so we can modify or add something to our activities so that we can hear better in the future and experience more in the future. Is that clear?
Pretty clear, but I'll listen to it again.
In other words, if we have some taste, some experience that's superior, then we want to get more of it. Even in the material world, if people have a superior experience, something that they enjoy, then they want more of it, whatever it is. Then they want to find out how to enjoy, get more of it, and how to enjoy it even more. So they have to find out from people how to do it. So they go to the movies, they watch television, basically about the same thing, you know. How to enjoy sense gratification and make money. So they have some taste. That's the only taste in the material world. So they watch television, they read books, they go to the movies, you know, whatever they can do. Take instructions from the acharyas, the movie, you know, actors and actresses, how they do it, how it's supposed to be done according to them. And then they take them as the authority and try it out, see if it works. And if they get a higher taste or some taste, then they, you know, get more enthusiastic to learn more, get more instruction, become more expert. So similarly in spiritual life, if we actually have some taste for spiritual life, then we have to find out how to get more of a taste. So we hear from those who supposedly have more of taste than we have, more experience, and then we try to understand what they're saying, how it fits in my life practically. Then I try to apply it, and then if it works, then naturally I want to get more. Then we develop more faith that there is a process that works, and how to, you know, what's the next step. And that way we progress in spiritual life. But if it's just like, I believe, and I'm, because I'm supposed to believe, and it's really all kind of mysterious anyhow, and no one really knows until after they leave this body, and, you know, it's really hard to make advancement in Kali Yuga, it seems all kind of vague, and everyone has a different opinion about everything anyhow, and so I don't really have to, you know, just whatever I feel like, whatever opinion comes to my mind at that time that seems nice, I'll follow that, and it's not really kind of like, there's so many strange things in these books that, you know, who can really take it so seriously, and maybe it's meant for Treta Yuga or Satya Yuga, but it's, you know, when we get into that mood and, you know, just, you know, don't try and make any austerity, don't try to really understand too clearly what's going on, because then we don't really go anywhere. We just kind of like remain in the same position, wonder what's really all about, and, you know, and we talk about the bliss and the ecstasy, and but we don't really experience very much of it. The only enthusiasm we have is when we talk about it. Then we kind of miss out that actually there is a science, that we can experience it, and if we follow the science, then gradually it'll become within the realm of our experience. So that's what we have to do. It may not be immediate. As soon as I perform some austerity, it's not that Krishna says, oh, austerity, you've done 3 minutes of austerity, that's worth at least, you know, 1 minute of bliss. So here is, you know, we'll eject you with 1 minute of bliss. Oh, thanks a lot, Krishna. It may not be so mechanical. But along the line, we have to understand what the science is and how Krishna is working, and see that, you know, if we do follow the right process, we'll actually get the right result. Yes?
The science of Buddha's propelling identities, the conclusion at the end he makes is that if one wants to believe in UFOs, there's enough sort of evidence and eyewitness accounts to support that. If somebody doesn't, everything's vague enough to feel comfortable about that also. So I was thinking it could be applied to spiritual life also, according to one's faith, one's desire, hearing from Guru, Sadhu, Sastra, etc. There's enough to inspire one to keep going in spiritual life, develop faith. But if someone doesn't want to do that, everything's vague enough to feel comfortable about avoiding that.
Yeah, as long as there's nice prasadam, then. You know, the kirtan's good enough, then, you know, keep on coming.
So I guess just according to one's desire, you know, which direction you're going in.
Yeah.
Just also saying that the proof that you're advancing in spiritual life is that your fever for materialism went down and you gave up. So you can see that a lot of people that claim, if it was not the right path or whatever, but then you see that they don't actually really take it. So whenever you think of a devotee, you generally think of a devotee being simple and not driving around in a fancy car and so many things that are easy.
Well, that's some of the proof. It's not the absolute proof. If you tell that to Pundarik Vidyanidhi, Gadadhar Pandit thought that was the proof. Then he was surprised to find out he was a great devotee. So it's more than the proof. The general proof, I mean, external proof, is that for us, as Prabhupada explains, is that there's many things. one has to become learned in Krishna consciousness in order to understand things as they actually are. It's not such a simple thing. But one of the things is that the devotee is supposed to be following the principles, chanting 16 rounds and endeavoring to spread Krishna consciousness and following the regular principles of devotional service. So that those are some of the indications that Prabhupada gave. That one is dedicating whatever he has to the service of Krishna. Otherwise, you know, Parikshit Maharaj, he drove around in, you know, horses, and big horses. He had a whole kingdom, but we can't say he was in Maya, because he utilized everything for Krishna. But of course, if one is a sannyasi or something like that, then generally a sannyasi means to is generally more austere and more simple, so that may be different. But on the other hand, Prabhupada showed another example. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada showed another example that a sannyasi can also, you know, utilize the current things like jet airplanes and other things in the preaching service of Krishna. Yeah.
He was referring more to things like you're saying, like the regular principles. Like they're not attached to meeting, intoxication, gambling, sex life. These are the
Also they come in
material enjoyment that are, you know, other things seem to use in the Christian service, but those can't.
Yeah. Also, I mean, regular principles, all the regular principles means also they hear and chant about Krishna, and that those are also part of the regular principles. The positive and the negative are both there. So it takes some learning to understand what a position of a devotee is in, what position they're in. Otherwise, we take things very superficially, then we just walk around and just label people, and it makes it very easy. I don't have to think too much, and I figure out everyone figured out. Anything else?
Also, once you intellectually believe that you are a spirit and not physical body, behaving body, then the whole value system changes. Then your actions and reactions will be molded by this understanding, even though you may not realize it fully as yet.
Yeah. Beginning to understand we're not this body, but we also have to understand that we're servants of Krishna. Then everything else will fit into line gradually. First, that was if we work here, activities performed in knowledge strengthen one's advancement in real knowledge. So, if we theoretically understand something and try to work sincerely according to the theory, then gradually Krishna will help us and reveal the reality to us. Okay, thank you very much. Grantharaj, Srimad Bhagavatam, Kijai, Srila Prabhupada, Kijai, Ananda.